Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Recovery Cast. Look for us on the web at myrecoverycast.com, where you will find this and all our past episodes. We've posted there all the links and information you will need to subscribe via iTunes, Stitcher, or any other podcast app. Or if you prefer, you can just download or stream the episodes right from the website. Please share that link with your friends in recovery as well. But enough with the plugs. The main event today is an interview with Karen B., a member who got clean in the mid-70s in Southern California when young women in NA were not so common. I don't think I can say much to set this up, because the heart and soul you're about to hear dwarfs anything I might say about it. I'm just glad you're doing yourself the favor of listening in today. So be ready to open your heart and sit back now for one of the true treasures of the Fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous.
Yeah, Karen, we generally start off with the same areas of inquiry, which is, you know, where and when did you encounter the message of Narcotics Anonymous?
Okay, well, it's kind of twofold. So the very first meeting I ever went to, August 25th, 1976, I had called up, and I don't know why, I have no idea what made me call up AA. And AA gave me this address for what is known as the North Hollywood Group on Radford Street in Studio City. So I don't even remember how I got there. I stayed in my car. I walked into this meeting by myself. And I don't know how I ended up at this table. And at the head of this table sat Jimmy Kinnon. And a whole rows of addicts from a recovery house, from Cry Help. And I was so disoriented and so sick, and I didn't know what I was doing in this room. And he starts talking. I have no idea what he's talking about. Turns out it was the last meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that Jimmy Kinnon ever chaired before he completely started focusing solely on NA and attending NA. Hmm. But my very first meeting was his last one of AA. And then I didn't know about NA for 4 months. I just kept doing this AA thing, and then this man named Jose Torres, who's now passed away, kept telling me about this world convention coming up in Ventura. I don't know what number that would have been, Ron. Maybe the fifth or fourth, or
I think it was the sixth. That was it. It was quite a historic one, actually. That would have been 76, right? Yeah, the first one was 71, and 76 was the sixth one.
Okay, so he kept trying to get me to go to this thing. At that time, all the addicts went to this North Hollywood group at lunch, the noon meeting. And by then, the drugs were mostly out of my system, and I was nothing but a big ball of panic, and I could not imagine myself going there. But just from his bothering me about it, I decided, okay, just to shut up Jose, I'm going to go to an NA meeting. And it was, I think, a Friday night Cry Help or something. And, oh my God, I landed. There I was. Mm-hmm. And that's really where I got introduced to NA. Now, the strange schism for me is, at that time, NA was mostly, the men were all, the prison type. And the women were generally real hardcore street stuff. And what I was at that time was just a very mentally disturbed young person who couldn't be awake and not be loaded, with huge damage from my childhood. And you didn't talk about that sort of thing back then. You talked about needles, you talked about turning tricks, you talked about prison and ducats and going for the okie doke and all this language that I'd never heard before. And I didn't use ain't in a sentence. And it was almost like if you hadn't come from that background, you were accused sort of being there for alternative reasons, like you're there to meet a guy. And I got to tell you, this was not a goal of mine. I was not interested in meeting someone from prison. And I felt like I had a desperation that some of the other people didn't seem to have. They were so cool that they sort of talked about going to and from prison in sort of a fluid way, to and from the streets in sort of a fluid way, kind of like they were just taking a break or I don't know what it was. And for me, I was really hanging on something, anything by the fingernails, just because I didn't have this thread to keep me engaged on the planet anymore. Mm. I remember having this big dilemma when I was new. I knew I wanted to blow my brains out, but I couldn't figure out if I wanted to put the gun here or here. And someone mailed me a picture of a guy with his lower jaw shot off. He had put the gun in his mouth and now he was living his life like this, mm. You know? And so that was very discouraging. And then it wasn't until I had 7 years, it occurred to me, doofus, two guns.
Ah. Well, Karen, before we move on from your first meeting, would that be your clean date from you know,
yeah.
Your...
Yeah.
So you're what I've heard referred to as a one-timer.
So far.
Yeah. Now, I've also heard that North Hollywood clubhouse, that was a clubhouse, was it not?
Yeah.
And that was Jimmy Kay's AA connection prior to his commitment to NA, correct?
Yeah.
Because I actually called out there once doing some historical research and they answered the phone and I'm talking to this guy and I told him what I was doing and he said, oh yeah, we're the birthplace of NA. So, I mean, there's some truth to that.
Oh, arrogance there.
Well, but that's really the early NA meetings grew out of that clubhouse, didn't they?
No, I wouldn't say
that. Okay, I got it wrong then.
I wouldn't say that. I would say that was a very arrogant person. I would say the first NA meetings that I'm aware of grew out of places that Jimmy intentionally found separate from that clubhouse. But if you read historically, it's people from that fellowship who supported him and really getting it off the ground. But he made a lot of effort to keep it separate.
Yeah, well, speaking of clubhouses, well, we'll get to that in a minute. I want to ask you about the Survivors Club, but you were sharing about your experience as a newcomer and just finding that really interesting to try to get that picture, like, because there were a couple of things about it. One was you were coming from sort of the mental institutions. Did you come from an institution, or you were saying that you weren't coming?
Oh, I was, you know, during the hippie era, it was very easy to hide your mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
People just assumed it was the drugs.
Yeah. Okay, so you were coming from that background anyway, and stepping into a background that was, or stepping into an environment that was really pretty, let's just say, people coming from a correctional background were more common there. So
yeah.
The kind of sharing you were hearing and all of that, did you begin to find your own voice and share the way you, I imagine you were just compelled to share the way you wanted to share? What was your experience trying to share in that environment?
I felt very stifled. I felt like I couldn't really, the things that I wanted to talk about, very often I was shamed for talking about them. For instance, if I talked about the abuse of my childhood, this was way before all this inner child stuff happened, mm-hmm. The whole Bob Earl movement. And so you didn't talk about your past. There was a very famous catchphrase about blaming. If you're talking about your childhood and the things that happened to you, you were blaming. Mm-hmm. And today we take responsibility. So I was this big ball of torture, hidden torture. And I just tried to sort of fit in and slyly, you know, I was never quiet. I was always loud and I always had punchlines. It's the same reason I was always kicked out of school. And I had a lot to say about the whatever drama I was going through contemporarily, but in terms of where I came from, I just got really, really quiet because I was waiting to be kicked out at any moment. And it was my membership was very tenuous. Like, my first husband would be someone who would say, why the hell are you going to those meetings? You don't have a problem. He was a hype. I don't think anyone took me necessarily seriously. But then the great thing about being desperate and about being a tortured soul is your behavior will identify you as an addict. So even if people are judgmental about prison or no prison, just the way you act and react to things qualifies one. My entire recovery, I have identified much more with people who were locked up for long periods of time. And I think it's because of the kind of childhood that I had. But I was actually physically locked up as well as emotionally and mentally imprisoned. There were times I got locked in dark closets. There was a very heavy-handed, punitive control in the house that I lived in. So having to sort of slide around in a very dangerous culture and never reveal how you felt inside was a very familiar place to me.
That's fascinating. It makes sense. It fits. And I was going to ask you, and maybe you just answered it, but you, on the one hand, felt a bit out of place there. On the other hand, you said it kind of felt like home.
I don't know about home. See, the thing about being an actor is that I become very adapted in unfamiliar situations. I look around for all the cues and codes of what makes up the environment that I'm in, and then I decide what to take and select and what to portray. For instance, there was Joanne T. had long acrylic nails. She was one of the first people I ever met who had these really long artificial nails, and her hair was just so, and I looked at that and I decided, okay, that's how I'm going to operate. I'm going to have to go get claws. I'm going to have to learn how to sit a certain way with my knee crossed, you know, my leg crossed at the knee just so, and my hands placed in my lap and try and have a poker face. And, you know, you just sort of watch these things. That's how you really hide your authentic self. Because for me, I came from a world where it's not safe to be real. And I did not feel safe necessarily in Narcotics Anonymous. When I felt safe was when I heard Jimmy's truck coming up into the Survivors Club parking in the lot there, the rumble of the truck, or when Pepe was sitting in Monday Night Moor Park, his little powder blue fishing hat. Or, or believe it or not, when Mr. Hip Slick and Cool Bob B would come sliding into the club, you know, with his apple cap over one eye. Sometimes it wasn't necessarily a great idea to feel safe under those circumstances, but I felt grounded in something. And that's what I miss now. That's what was so hard for me about when Bob Barrett passed was you kind of lose this net, which is why I'm so glad Dave is here. But how many conventions have I gone to when they do the countdown and I'm the person with the most time in the room? And it's a great honor, a great ego boost, and it's so unsafe. It's so unsafe. God.
Karen, let me ask you, did you pick a sponsor early on?
There was this really strange woman in the AA clubhouse. I asked her, and it lasted like a week. That didn't work. And then there was this British woman named Rita. Rita, and Rita was a sister of a very famous actor. And she was British and a flamenco dancer and very eccentric. and she had a sponsor who was an old grizzly character actor named Larry Black, and he didn't take any shit from Rita, told her she was boring, which was phenomenal for her to hear because she thought of herself as exotic. And she had 11 years when he sort of put her in her place, and immediately she asked him to be her sponsor. And so I had been sharing about some kind of drama, and I ran outside. Something about my ex-husband, and he was going to set the mafia on me, and they were all going to kill me. And she came outside very languidly and said, "First of all, you're not important enough for the mafia to come after. Second of all, do you know you're boring? You're absolutely boring." And it really hurt my feelings. And so the next day I asked her to be my sponsor. So she was my sponsor for 10 years. And then I had a critically ill child, and Rita disappeared on me. And I couldn't fathom being that close to a sponsor and having them just evaporate while I was going through this. And I found out through the course of events, she had not shared with me that she had a child who died at 2 years old. So it was difficult for her to be around it. But I was so deeply involved in NA at that point and felt like I was really growing away from her, and I was hurt. And then she had married a guy who died a couple years later, and she started taking a certain medication, and I became judgmental of her. She took something to sleep, and I was from that school that no matter what. And I judged her, and so I never told her directly, but in my mind, I fired her. Like you can fire someone who saves your life for a decade. Just that self-centered thing. So I moved to Santa Cruz and I found a wonderful woman. She was my sponsor for 18 years. And again, she was somebody who began going only to illness and recovery meetings and wouldn't answer the phone. And I found myself reading inventories into her answering machine. And that went on for a couple of years, and she would deny everything I'm saying right now vehemently. "No, that's not how it was. And how can you say these terrible things? And after 18 years, you'd do this. And we were like family," and on and on and on and on and on. And, you know, and I've made my amends and they weren't good enough. And I've been with the sponsor I'm with now for probably, I want to say like 8 or 9 years. But I don't do recovery without a sponsor. Not that I used one a lot. I would say for the last 20 years, I only call when something's really messed up. Or to say, yes, I called my sponsor.
So let me ask, you moved from Southern California to Northern California. What did you find different, if anything, about the fellowship when you got up there?
It was much newer. Northern California had a very well-established program in the San Jose, Berkeley area. I remember when California was one sort of region, Northern California would come down when it was time to do business to Southern California. It was one big body before it split off. And we sort of circled each other looking suspiciously about who was doing this thing better. And there was one really scary woman named Snoopy. She was married and she had a husband and they looked like identical twins and buddy. And I just knew she was one of those people judging me as somebody who didn't really belong. And she was really street and really tough. And she's my grand sponsor now. Mm-hmm. And I love every single cell, every little particle of her. And we've been known to just cuddle. So I landed in the little town of Santa Cruz, and NA was very new, not a lot of meetings, kind of all the way back to where I started from, where the program was very sort of mixed up and enmeshed with AA. And so it was necessary to start a few meetings to establish it as something separate.
I want to take a slight detour now and get more personal. I've heard you share from the podium and some of the stuff that you shared about your childhood. You touched on it a moment ago. Some of the stuff that you share about your mother. Can you just tell us that story?
So this is difficult for me because I've been on the forgiveness tour for so long. And part of having Stockholm syndrome is you don't talk about the mistakes that your abuser has made, but I'll just do my very best. They say that they do the best with the tools that they had. My mother had power tools and she was part of a demolition crew. And she was someone who had been physically violated at a very early age by a relative. So by the time she was enslaved and put in the prison camp in Auschwitz, she was already tormented. And she went through 4 years of that experience by serving under Dr. Mengele. And what her job was to paint the atrocities of his experiments. That's how she survived. Mm-hmm. So when she came out of there, it's not really a parenting course. So only 5 years later, she has children. And this is after going to Paris and starving in Paris and then meeting an artist. It's really quite a remarkable story, but not for here. And she has children. And what she discovers about me is that I am ultra, ultra sensitive. And she's afraid that when the Nazis come, I'm going to break. So she goes on a course to toughen me up. I can't tell you how many people have told me how tough I am, which I think is a joke. So she reenacts little mini versions of what happened to her on me. And I won't go into details because some of it is pretty twisted. But suffice to say, by the time I came to NA, I was very injured and damaged and spiritually bereft. I had no concept. I've heard so many people talk about, oh, it's a good thing you weren't Catholic, that you didn't come here with all kinds of damage that you had to overcome to have a loving higher power. First of all, I know a lot of Catholics who have a wonderful loving higher power. And second of all, the edge that people who had been raised in a religion and had to overcome a religion, the edge that you have is you know what it feels like to believe that in something at some point. And so from where I come from, I never had a feeling of believing. I didn't know what it felt like in my body to believe in something or in my heart. And here I'm told all you need is a higher power. You can pick one of your choosing. Well, you know, they say you can pick a doorknob, you can pick a tree. And to me, that was all the same as some magic thing out there that allegedly loved me. And they would say, pretend he's your father and you're going to crawl into his lap. And I would say, that's not a safe place for me. You don't understand. I cannot sit on my father's lap. Yeah. So I get in recovery and I got about a year and a half and I say to this guy, you know, I'm trying to work these steps, but what's happening is I've got my mother and I can't forgive her because this happened and this happened and this happened and this happened. And he said, you need to serve her as you would serve a newcomer. So I took this information, always the first one to abandon myself, because that was the lesson from abusive childhood, is always abandon yourself first. That's being a good girl, right? So I started serving my mother. I would drive 6.5 hours to her house in Northern California and clean it from top to bottom when I got out of the car. And this is with a spinal defect. I'd be in such hideous pain and I'd be on my hands and knees scrubbing her floor, trying to get over this thing that I had that was tormenting me that I thought would get me loaded, or trying to make her love me, or trying to do something. I served and I served and I served until I realized I was going to lose my mind with this hatred that I was having. And it all kind of culminated when I started when I got married, really. And I went into counseling. And what I was told is that there are no shortcuts to forgiveness, that you have to walk through hatred and anger and grief first to get there. And I said, well, God, I've cried every day of my childhood. Isn't that enough? And they said, no, you've walked through it as a victim. Now you need to walk through it as a survivor. And they gave me this sort of mental imagery ways of walking through this. Picture this huge bucket of shame and abuse that you're carrying. And picture your higher power at the other end of this walkway. And now I want you to carry this bucket over to your higher power and give it to the care of your higher power. Hand this bucket. And then you and your higher power are going to take it and you're going to hand it back to your abuser. And this all sounds very touchy-feely, but it was so hard for me to do this kind of thing. And it was very hard to reconcile in recovery. Now, at this time, there was a fad in Narcotics Anonymous, and the fad was to do your inner child work and to talk about it. And so now people who had been to prison had teddy bears all of a sudden and started looking. You remember this?
Yes.
And looking at their childhood. And for me, it was a floodgate that was indescribable. It was so huge for me. And so when people would start talking about it, instead of shaming me and saying, don't go there, you're blaming, suddenly I was a resource for people. And they would say, well, if Karen could survive that, I can survive anything. Oh my God, I'll never forget. I was in this meeting and it was full of very tough prison types. And I thought, oh, wow, they're all with me now. We're doing our inner child work. And I get up to the podium and I said, I'll never forget the day my abuser came to attack me. And for once I kicked and I broke her collarbone. And there was silence in the room. And I thought, ooh, have I lost my crowd? I was so excited to finally give up that secret. And I walked back to my chair and this guy, Bob T, looks at me, shakes his head and he goes, I ain't never done nothing to my mama. And I felt separate and worse. And, oh God, I just broke the code. And if I had known then that he had ripped her off from her coin purse, I would have been better. But apparently that was some big barrier you didn't cross. You didn't injure your mother. So I give birth to this critically ill child. And how do you tell this kid you're trying to save his life and all of a sudden my mother shows up in a huge way for this child and me? And I find that I need her. Everything starts changing in recovery, as you know, that when you turn your will and your life over to a power greater than yourself, anything can happen if you're willing to have this revolution. You don't have to just stay clean. Things happen beyond your wildest dreams. I'm in Cedar Sinai. I'm on the intensive care unit, and I'm beside myself. It's been months up there, and I'm at my wit's end. My milk is starting to dry up, and they need it to give to her in her NG tube. And I look, and I see my mother over her isolette. She's come from Northern California. She hasn't told me that she'd be there. And there she is leaning over the isolette. And I stood there looking at her thinking, oh my God, you're the world's most wonderful person. I get a break now, you're here. And I'm so happy. And I walk into the lobby and the phone rings and it's her calling me from Northern California. She had not come down. I run back to the room that was steps away and she's not there. How do you explain that? I'll tell you exactly how I explain that. I'm not a particularly metaphysical person, but I'll tell you right now, that was an angel. That was mercy. And that whole experience with having this terribly sick child started creating this healing between she and I. When you give birth to an ill child, the state of California is required to contact you and make sure you're not going to abuse this kid, because the majority of children who are abused were children who are in physically or emotionally sensitive. They have differences and problems. And so California comes, and within 72 hours, they're required to put an envelope on your baby's bed to tell you must be contacted and have an interview. They have to see if you're a fit parent. So I meet up. I have 8 years clean, and I meet up with this people, and they decide immediately, oh, shit, she's got to go to counseling. And what I'm told by this wonderful woman is that when one becomes aware of being in this situation of being very abused and not wanting to repeat the pattern and having this ill child, all of this can be used to advise you to be more cautious. And also, you need to teach your children that if grandma does anything unusual, you tell me immediately, and that's the end of hanging out with grandma. I'm here to protect you. This was a time when I decided to move to Santa Cruz. And by a series of incredible coincidences, we end up buying the house across the street from Crazy Grandma. Now, let me tell you, I had purchased a house in Boulder Creek, far away. They'd called me up and said, please, can we take our house out of escrow? It's going to injure my daughter if we sell this house. I say, fine, no problem. I won't sue you. And I'm sitting at this table and I'm crying. I can't find another house to move to. And my house in North Hollywood has been sold. There's an ad in the paper of a house in the San Lorenzo Valley. I call up the phone number and this guy answers. And I go, where is the house located? He says, Felton. I go, Felton? No way. I'm in Felton right now. He says, yeah, well, I'm actually in a part of Felton called Zianti. I say, no way. Zianti? I'm in Zianti right now. He goes, who is this? And I said, my name's Karen. I'm sitting in my mother's house. He goes, okay, well, I'm in Zianti, and I'm on a street called Creekside Way. And I got scared, and I said, I'm in a house on Creekside Way. He goes, what address are you at? I said, 340. He goes, Nina? I said, no, that's my mom. He goes, look over the fence. You're calling 329 Creekside Way, and I'm not really selling my house. I just put it in the paper to see what someone would pay. So I bought this house, because you buy that house when that happens. And this starts a 20-year forgiveness tour. Fighting with this woman, trying to make it right with my program, working steps, writing inventories, my kids going over there. And here's the terrible part. My kids are going over there, and she's the mother I never had to them. Mm. To this day, they call her the other parent. Pisses me off. She's feeding them. She's nurturing them. She's reading them stories ad nauseum. She's cuddling them. I mean, everything. My children had the most wonderful childhood, running back and forth between the two houses and playing down at the creek. And so one day the Today Show calls us up. And the Today Show says, we know that your mother has been painting to survive from Dr. Mengele. She's always wanted these paintings back, because she feels she's still enslaved by the Nazis. We want to help you get these paintings back. We want to fly you out to Auschwitz and help. I am terrified of Nazis. I mean, one of the hardest things for me to get over was when I got to NA and people talking in chorus. To me, it sounded like a Nazi rally. And the keep coming back, it works, was just like a hair away from this, right? It's scary to me. So also, I had a fear of flying back then. I thought, oh, shit, I'm going to volunteer to go on an airplane to Poland to go see the Nazis with my abuser, and all that's not resolved yet. And, you know, this deal is like you can have recovery or you can have samurai recovery. You know, like Samurai Chef on The Tonight Show. You know, he wasn't just a chef. He was like, it's like if this situation arises to do something horrifying and wonderful, you got to do it, right? So my mom and I go on a Polish jet to see the Nazis, right? And there's a lightning storm. And we go there anyway, and we try to get her artwork back, and we're fighting. All the shit from the past is coming up. She's telling me to be quiet, not say anything. I'm an embarrassment to her. She hopes I go home. And it's just this big mess with this film crew from New York. And I'm in the bathroom, and she's about to send me home because I'm not behaving correctly. I was supposed to be stoic, and here I am, this big ball of feelings. And I get on my knees in the bathroom, which is not what Jews do. But I get on my knees in the bathroom because I wanted to make sure I had a juicy surrender. And I said, you know what, God, if this is the end of this relationship, if this is as far as recovery can take me, so be it. I surrendered this whole thing to you. I'm going to fly back home. That's the end. And this is what I'm going to tell everybody in the program is that, you know, you do everything you can for forgiveness and redemption. And that's the end. So I get up and my mother walks into the bathroom and says, I'm going to pretend as if nothing ever happened. I'm like, what? As if nothing ever happened? Years and years of abuse and beating, and I hit her and we screamed, and then I used drugs and then I got clean. And she used to say, the most important day in your life is May 5th. And I'm like, Cinco de Mayo? Whoa, that was the day I was liberated from Auschwitz. You wouldn't be here if I wasn't. And I said, no, the most important day of my life is August 25th, 1976. That's the day I was liberated from my Holocaust. So we go back to Auschwitz. We're walking through Auschwitz arm in arm, and now we're united because we've decided we're going to act as if nothing ever happened. And it made all the difference. We walked through there like a united front, clean slate. God was on his, her throne. We walk into this barrack together. She goes, this is phony. All of this was torn down. This place is like Disneyland, and now they put up this barrack to be dramatic. But I can't find a bathroom. I said, you know, I need to go to the bathroom too. And we got this great idea at the same time that we were going to piss inside one of their barracks. And it brought us together. It was a baptism. Hmm. We squatted down in this barrack, far away from the film crew, and we pissed together. We pissed on the earth that killed everybody and absorbed the ashes of everyone we ever were and left us lost and floundering and damaged and damaging each other. And from that moment, the forgiveness tour started.
Wow.
And so we started becoming the best of best of best of friends. And she started admitting things to me that I'm going to take to my grave. She made me swear, but some of the things that she did to survive are in my heart. Things that I know, I'll never betray that. And a couple years later, she got cancer and it was terminal. And the doctor told me, and not her, and told me I had to tell her, and he walked out of the room. What crap is that? So I told her, and for the next 2 years, I was honored with the privilege of being able to take care of her, hands-on, and it was ugly. I had to put packing inside of her gut with sticks and wick things away and rush her to emergency, and as she died, I held her in my arms, which so many kids do. I'm not unique, and I got to be in bed with her. And I got to sing those songs. Froh zu sein, bedach wes wenig, doch es früh heißt es dein König. Happiness, a little thing, but when you're happy, you're a king. And I got to sing it to her in her little ear and rock her in my arms. And I would like to say she went peacefully, but she went horrified. She had no higher power. She never got her artwork back. She was never freed. But Narcotics Anonymous enabled me to hold her and sing the happiness song in her language.
That is a powerful story.
So a couple of years ago, Jeff surprised me with a trip back to the forest of Bilovitz in the Czech Republic, where she used to walk with her mother. You know how the Nazis tried to kill us all and separate us all, but I got to take her ashes and put them in the forest where she walked with her mother. So we're all together now. Mm. So, ha ha. And that's why I hate it when people bandy about the term an NA Nazi. You don't know what you're saying. You are saying that someone who is maybe rabidly passionate about Narcotics Anonymous is equal to somebody who injected phenol into the hearts of children. I hope to never hear that expression again.
I'm with you. That trip you took back to spread her ashes, I was sort of watching that on Facebook. You did some videoing of that, and I was crying like a baby sitting at my computer because I had heard this story, and I felt so connected to you. And to know that you were there getting to have that final moment, a little, what do you call that kind of camera you strap to your head?
GoPro. Somebody loaned us a GoPro.
Yeah, you had a GoPro, and you were walking out in the kind of forest area where your mom used to walk, and you were looking for the right place to spread her ashes. And then you finally did. And when you shared also about going to a meeting that night, or I don't know if it was that night.
No, but it was right afterwards. We were in Vienna, and boy, did I need a meeting. And the only meeting that night, we find out, is, I guess, a men's meeting in Farsi. They're not into Jews. This is what I'm thinking.
Right.
Oh, they're not into Jews and they're not into women. I don't care. I need a meeting. So Jeff, God bless this man, takes me to this meeting. And we're sitting in there. And it's stifling hot summer in Vienna. Just horribly humid. And there's all these Iranian men speaking in Farsi. And I'm thinking to myself, I can feel that this is Narcotics Anonymous in here. And I am very grateful to be in here. I know I'm not going to get called on, and I'm not going to be able to talk about my pain in spreading these ashes. And I really could use some support. So sure enough, they call on Jeff. They don't call on me. I'm the only woman in the room. So finally, I just blurt. I'm Karen. I'm an addict. I got to talk. Blah, 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 blah. And I'm talking, you know me. So I get it all out. They change the meeting to English, very broken English. They are the most loving, wonderful men. Opened their hearts, embraced me physically as well as mentally, spiritually, and that is not done in that culture. They started bringing me all kinds of foods I was unfamiliar with. Their children came to meet me. My God, what a wonderful experience. Everything that I needed. And it had to come that way, you know? I had to, for this healing to be really complete, it had to, this crap that we're fed on the news about how we are enemies. Once you're in this fellowship, you know that it's just crap.
Yes. Yeah, so that was a capper to that experience. I mean, you got it from a couple of angles there. There was the whole Nazi thing, and the fact that there was some, I don't know if you would use the word closure. That word is challenging for people, but some kind of experience of fruition of with your mom and that whole experience. And then this other kind of cultural divide that, like you said, we're faced with in the news, and then how we in NA just get to transcend all of that stuff.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
How many people live their lives wondering if their life meant anything, if anything significant would ever happen in their lives?
Wow.
And look at us.
Exactly. Yeah, there is no doubt. There is no doubt. I've thought of that before, that you know, my ego might want to point to A, B, and C as my life meant something, but my heart can look around and say, the
the connections I have with people in Narcotics Anonymous, the way I've been able to be with my family as a result of my recovery, et cetera, my life matters.
Well, and you are such a paragon of service worldwide. It makes me feel so inadequate. Like when I was thinking about doing this recording, it was like, I don't have that to offer.
I got to at least respond to that and say there's no paragon about it. There's a hell of a blessing when the fellowship asks you to serve in a certain kind of way, and you get these unbelievable opportunities to be involved in things and to be present and bear witness to other people's service and to be connected to the fellowship in that way. So just to say that I have been given an unbelievable gift in terms of some of the service I've been allowed to do. But also, you know, it reminds me of my wife a little bit when I think about why we were so interested in hearing your share, that there are many paths in Narcotics Anonymous, many people going, having really extraordinary recovery experiences that are not involved in the kind of the service picture. I mean, certainly your service is unbelievable, and as is my wife's. It just doesn't play out in that big service structure arena. Lots of opportunity for all of that in Narcotics Anonymous. Can you just share a little bit about how your career unfolded in recovery?
Well, the only thing I ever wanted to be was a comedian. From the time I watched the Ed Sullivan Show Sunday night at 9, that was my safe place from my hell of a life. If I could get my mother to let me stay up late to watch Ed Sullivan, I was okay for that period of time. I needed comedians. Comedy, you know, you could get out of a licking if you were funny. I finally found a way of getting out of it is by if I could just come up with a joke to derail everything. It's also the reason why I was always kicked out of school and sent to the principal's office. It's always chronic jokes, one-liners. And all I ever wanted to be was that. I snuck into comedy clubs when I was underage. And yeah, anyway, I don't want to go there. There were some things I did with some famous people trying to be connected that, yeah. Anyway, so when I got clean, I got a year or so under the belt and I thought, oh good, now I can go do what I always wanted to do. First, I tried to be Joanne T. She was very successful as somebody in recovery programs. And back then you had to make yourself be a counselor immediately. That's how you got back on your feet. So I tried. It was abysmal, just dismal failure. I think of Marlene N. and Robert. Oh, gosh. They hired me. They worked with me for a year and at an alcoholism council. And my gosh, the things I did in counseling sessions, poor teenagers. I tried. But then, so I'm working in recovery, but at night, I'm going to the Comedy Store in Hollywood and going up on amateur nights. And so one night the store owner is there and she says, you're very good. I'm going to make you a regular. And I was ecstatic. And I remember driving home in my beat up little Toyota and screaming at the top of my lungs, I'm a Canadian. And I'm just screaming and I'm crying. I'm so excited. And that started a whole thing where I was working long hours and then going to the comedy club and they put me up at like 1 o'clock in the morning when if I was lucky, there was 1 to 3 people in the room because I was learning and I would suck and then I'd go home crying. And Don, my husband at the time, would say, why are you doing this to yourself? And I would say, it makes me happy. And I did it for about 4 years. I realized working in recovery, I was doing more harm than good. And I thought, okay, I'm going to really keep it this comedy thing, but I'm going to do manual labor during the day so it doesn't use brain power. And that started my adventure as a waitress and as a house cleaner. So I was doing that, and people in recovery were not supportive. They were really not okay. They were saying, there's alcohol, there's drugs in the nightclub, you have no business being there. What a terrible thing for you to do. But I couldn't stop. I wanted it so badly. And then after about 4 years, I got my first TV gig. And suddenly people in the program were like, we always knew you could do it. Can I have free passes?
they didn't take credit, though.
Okay. So after a while, then they decided, okay, we'll have a comedian at World. I know, we'll have a recovery comedian. And so we had been having little local talent shows in Hollywood. So I got asked to be the comedian at a big convention. And then I got unasked. I was told by someone at World that because I had gotten clean in AA, I could not be the comedian at the World Convention.
Oh my God.
Never mind that I had been the first clean comedian in NA. It's like, because I, and how many people started off in AA? But it was just, I was so hurt and I was so upset. But I got taken to World by Jose one Sunday afternoon. He had the keys to the office, and this was in the old World. And he sat me down and he showed me a list of people who could never speak at conventions and couldn't perform there because they'd gotten clean in AA. This was in the like mid 80s. And I was just devastated. And I just went about the business of being a comedian. I started touring the country and going to meetings all over the country and then up in Canada and just having this wonderful life and getting to work in big rooms in Vegas and this and that. And then I moved up here and I got a radio show and I kicked ass in a competition at the International Comedy Competition. I became a finalist and all these great things were happening. And so I have this child who's like critically ill and all of a sudden a surgery happens and she's recovered and my emotions kick in and everything that I had to compartmentalize and push back starts coming out. And I think I had a breakdown. And regardless of the fact that I'd been on national TV and radio and clubs all over, I couldn't do comedy anymore. I was completely broken from the experience of this sick child. And you know what happened, Ron? I ended up on my hands and knees scrubbing toilets at a conference center. It's all I could do was move my arm back and forth. I was so broken from feeling all the feelings in my recovery clean.
What was that about? What year would that have been?
92.
Okay.
So I couldn't do comedy anymore. I couldn't. And I didn't know what I would do with myself. And one day this guy who's a vice principal at a high school says, "You're a kid person. You need to work with kids." And I realized, you know, the other thing you wanted to be was a high school drama teacher. Because you wanted to find all the hurt kids like you, the disenfranchised kids. And you wanted to be the one person who believed in them. So I self-willed myself into a teaching program. I went to this local school that had a sort of an expedited 9-month program. I said, "I'm going to go here and get a credential." They said, "That's not how it's done. You apply and then you get funding." And I said, "No, you don't understand. I'm going to go to the classes, do all the homework, and you'll find funding for me. I'm sure you will." And that's exactly what happened. I started going, I went to classes, and sure enough, they found me a loan, and it was a horrible loan. It took years to pay, but I got my credential, and I got that other dream. I got to be a high school teacher, but I always felt like a failure because I didn't stick with comedy. And then one day I get this phone call. I'm at this high school building sets, and I hear it's World Service Office, and I think, oh, now what have I done? Now it was NAWS. I'm not sure. And I go, "Yeah." And they go, "We would like you to be one of the speakers at the World Convention in 2003, I think, in San Diego." And I'm in this driveway. I'm painting sets and I'm walking briskly. I fall to my knees and scrape the crap out of them. And I'm sobbing on this summer day on this asphalt because World is asking me. It's like I got my stripes. Like I was allowed to be a full member, like I wasn't barred. And I don't remember who called me on the phone, but I'm so grateful that I get to be included in this thing that I know is my heart and soul anyway. But see, my husband had just left me 26 years, and I didn't know how I was going to get up in front of people. Oh, and the best part, I had lost these two teeth. And so I had a plate in here, and you're telling me to get up and talk in front of 10,000 people going, my Karen is that's not good, right? I mean, I hate to say this, but can you imagine getting ripped away from Teresa? By, you know, like she finds someone else. And there you are 2 months later in front of 10,000 people. It's like having 10,000 proctology interns looking up your butt. Seeing deep inside, and there's no, you're so vulnerable. And I'm standing up there, and all I can think of is my fellowship, everything's getting healed that way. I get to be a full-fledged member. The pain of that is over. Yes, I have this hideous pain that my dreams are never going to come true of growing old with the person I've had children with. But God damn it, look at what NA is doing, how it's bursting at the seams. And all I could do was jump up on the table and scream. And people make fun of me. Aren't you that chick who stood up and screamed and pumped your fist? I couldn't speak. The only thing I could do to express myself was pump my fist in the air and howl because samurai, you know? Samurai recovery, no matter what. It was amazing.
Mm-hmm. Karen, I was in the room.
No, you weren't.
I sure as hell was.
No.
That's what I remember. You jumping up and, you know, throwing your hands in the air like that. I was there.
Well, then you know it's the truth. That's all.
I made that connection before. I think you probably did. Yeah, it was wonderful, and there was a lot of very raw emotion in you that day. I do recall that.
It was a mess. I was so hoping that flipper wouldn't fly out of my mouth.
You know, Karen, when you tell that. I guess what I find really moving about it is it's not a I reached the pinnacle story. I got to speak at the World Convention. It's more of a redemption story. I was fully embraced by my fellowship that I had felt had in some way alienated me because of this AA background in the early going, which when I hear you say that, I just have a hard time accepting it. I have a hard time even believing it, that they would have said, you are not eligible to speak because of your early, everybody at your time in your class, let's say, including Dave, including me, has an early AA background. So did they actually say that to you? Did they actually say to you?
Yes, that's what I was told.
Wow. That's just unbelievable to me.
Well, and the other part of it is there were people who were very upset about the way Jimmy left the program or the world structure. And I, from knowing Jimmy, I became part of the group that decided to be part of meetings where you could say what you want and, you know, didn't change your language and all that. I'd been part of that movement.
Okay. So
later.
Okay. But so let's talk just for a minute about people like Hank Magdaleno, who I never met Hank. I don't know Hank, but here's my association for him that he was a guy who was, you know, very involved in those, just a real kind of doing a lot of service, being very much a part of Narcotics Anonymous. And when the basic text was written, and so he was involved in that, in NA, and had something, let's just say 15 years clean or whatever, when this language change came about and people were not being asked to speak because they didn't use the language of NA when they did.
Well, let me be clear. It was not just being asked not to speak. It was being hissed at.
Yeah, yeah. I can believe that. I remember the culture at that time. That sometimes culture change comes with a lot of unseemly bullshit. But so what would you say about Hank? Did he sort of step away from NA, or how well did you know him?
I was not a personal friend. I used to attend a book study he had in Manhattan Beach where he used an AA 12 and 12. to discuss the steps.
Okay.
So I won't claim that I was a great personal friend of Hank. We knew of each other and I attended his study. And what we didn't like was being hissed at and booed at. And it was, you know, I said stripes before as if you could earn stripes, but it was really, when you look at a soldier getting patches ripped off of them, there's this feeling that you're no longer a complete member. And all this shit about you're a member when you say you are, what is full membership? I've asked that question. Full membership would be that you fluidly are permitted to do what God calls you to do in the Fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous. So if a human power would make a decision that you are not allowed to speak, that your life did not happen in a way that is approved or good PR, you're not a member.
Yeah.
It's a traditions violation.
I get it. And I remember when I first moved to Southern California, late 84 or throughout 85, I went to, I guess it's the meeting in Manhattan Beach, the Roll Street meeting, which is like the longest standing meeting right now, the longest standing meeting still meeting at its original location in the world, as I understand it.
Wow.
And George, Hank's brother, and Lily, I guess, was Hank's wife. Lily was kind of, you know, setting up the meeting and doing her thing. And I got into a conversation with her, and it really struck me that there was a price we were paying in Narcotics Anonymous at that time for the kind of culture change we were undergoing. And the price was that there were all these members who had been doing service and had been the voice and heart of Narcotics Anonymous for all these years were somehow becoming persona non grata by a certain, what would you say, movement within the fellowship that was trying to affect change in the way that we expressed our message and that sort of stuff. And
So you can look at it that way. You can say that first of all, look at the great cultures like Native American culture. Elders are venerated. They're honored. Life experience is very important. Look at Chinese culture. Any organization that banishes its elders is doomed to fail or at the least repeat mistakes that were already accomplished beautifully for you by elders who, you know, now all this talk about predecessors, it makes me laugh. The predecessors initially referred to are AA members.
Right.
Now people talk about long timers as predecessors. It's really weird. But there was, if I can say, there was a movement of people who wanted their stripes before they earned them. They wanted to be elders before they were elders. And so if they could discredit the class before them, then they could say, no, we are the bottom line because we have all the new information and the new language and we are people of the book, not people of the pamphlet. And so we're the ones that we're going to fly around and we're going to invest energy in planting the seed all over the world. And you can't come.
Mm. I get it. I do get it. I find it to be just such an unfortunate clash of perspectives in a way. And as you say, it's one thing to have a clash of perspectives and to say we're seeking to affect a kind of change that we think is important. That's one thing. That's noble enough. It's another thing to say, and those old timers are now simply won't do because they are of the older school. And fortunately, I think we recovered from that. In some ways, we're probably still recovering from that. I mean, you're sitting here, Bob Barrett weathered that. I thought Pepe weathered that beautifully. He was one of those who just sort of kind of shrugged and went, okay, they want me to say this now instead of that. Well, you know, he didn't seem, at least to me, to take it too hard. But, you know.
Well, Yeah, but if you remember the convention in Long Beach a few years before he died, when they had one of the New Guard speakers from Florida as the main speaker, or no, it was a guy with a handful of years who had had a gambling addiction, and here he is in the Saturday night main meeting, and we're about 15 of us crammed into a room with Pepe wanting to hear Pepe speak, but he had been disenfranchised because of who he was.
Was that the year he spoke outside?
No, this was up in a room. We were in a little room.
Okay. Well, I did not participate in that, but I do remember one of those conventions where Pepe was, they had him speak kind of in an outside venue, and the place, I mean, everywhere at that time, wherever Pepe spoke, the place was jammed. Like, he spoke at, I think, the first San Diego convention. And I was there, and there was like people lined up outside the door in every available place in the room, because he just had such a heart and soul of NA. And he was a little clean and sober, and that, so there were certain noses upturned. But you had to be pretty thick-spirited to not listen to Pepe share and be completely moved. I wish I could interview Pepe.
I wish you could, too.
Actually, I have interviewed Pepe, just as a side point. When we were working on It Works, How and Why, I had the privilege of kind of going around and doing some interviews that were just one-on-one, just recorded, and nobody has ever heard them. And one of them was with Pepe. I was at his house, and we set up some gear, and I sat there and asked Pepe about all 12 steps.
Jeanette was a good friend of mine.
Okay.
Well, the line that was being told at that time was, we don't want to confuse the newcomer. You know how confusing that was to us? Because we're looking at each other going, we weren't confused. Were you confused? No, we're not confused. Why are you talking about confusing the newcomer by having a double message? You know, and now, for instance, Jeff is one of these who's adamant about one disease. And that, of course, is my visceral reaction now when I hear people say clean and sober. I'm like, that's wrong. You know, you can't say that. And I do believe that it's one message. I'm really glad that I learned that NA is about an addiction and not a substance. These were good things. But the point I want to make one more point, is that if you knew Jimmy, if you sat with Jimmy on Thursday nights in the ashram, if you went to Jimmy's house while Betty was making Christmas cookies and sat at the table and listened to him, if you sat in meetings with Jimmy, when he clipped his dang fingernails with that dang clipper, it was really hard to hear that he was in distress and hurt and devastated. And it was really unreasonable and not to rally around him and to be excluded because of an affection for a man who started the thing that saved your life was so surreal. And even more surreal was in the late 80s, going down to the Southern California convention and finding that it was held in the sports arena. Oh my God, that NA was so big it was in a sports arena. And sitting in this room and having Fawn's film of Jimmy playing and hearing for the first time ever that he was being acknowledged as the founder was, I just bawled. I just cried and cried and cried and cried. And I felt like even if we never get to be full members, even if we are discredited for the rest of our lives, to be around to see him acknowledged as a founder is monumental. Wonder if they really mean it. Wonder if they're going to take it back.
I'm with you on how rich it was to see Jimmy acknowledged in that way at that time. There's still this thing is moving slow, this train of healing in Narcotics Anonymous, and there's still more to do, more to go to sort of heal old rifts or
Maybe it's when we all die who are involved in them.
Well, I think there's part of it, though, is being kept alive by the fact that people are coming to NA with a certain language that's given to them by drug court, by the rehabs that they're coming out of. And there are reactions in meetings that very quickly can make those people feel unwelcome. So the language, what I have long referred to as the language crusades, there are elements of that just keep happening.
Yeah.
And I think perhaps the lesson that I would urge out of your experience and mine as well is that patience, tolerance, and acceptance and love has got to lead the way. I mean, in my experience, people will start to sound the same if they're around each other long enough, and it doesn't.
Yes, and that's what troubles me about those organizations that are trying to split up NA into factions and have their own literature. And I just don't think that's the solution. I think we have to put on our big girl and big guy panties, sit down together and talk, even if it takes a month of just talking and talking and talking and not being reactive until we form some kind of a bond. Because as soon as we become disunified, we become less effective.
I agree. All right, well, let me say, first let me just ask Dave, do you have any more questions or anything you'd like to pursue before we...
No, I don't. I just want to point out that when I talked to Karen as a preliminary to this, she was concerned that she didn't have a good history story. And I said, Karen, this isn't about history. A number of our episodes have dealt with history. And really, Ron, I think, shot out the first text to me several weeks ago that, you know, we really need to orient this toward people and their recovery. And there's just a vast array of folks out there who have these compelling messages like you do. And I just really want to thank you for sharing.
Thank you so much.
Time
I can't imagine why anybody would care, but thank you.
Yeah.
You're going to find out that people do care.
I think so too. And what I wanted to say is, you know, like when I hear you speak or when I been with you at just regular meetings and again in this interview, what's so striking is that you put your whole heart and soul, you give something. I just want to acknowledge something that you give something, that you go deep and you deliver something that it's got to be almost like disturbing on a level to be that honest and that go that deep. And I just really appreciate it. I love you a lot, Karen.
I love you so much. And I think what I have to say is that the reason why I have to open my heart and get real is because otherwise all the stuff that happened is just torture. And so to give it a purpose is means everything. Then it means none of it was just for pain. It makes it all useful. But I love you to bits. And I love Teresa. Give her a big hug and a kiss.
I will.
And Dave, please hug and kiss your dog.
I shall. Sleep with my feet.
Yay!
All right.
Love you guys.
Love you too. Okay. We'll see you all later.
Bye. Okay.